Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to The Auction Brief.
There's a joy in this game, is there not?
Taking you on a journey through fantasy football, the law, and life.
This is all yours to take. Depends on how much you want.
And now, your legal analyst and auction draft expert, here to help you dominate your fantasy drafts, your host, Drew Davenport.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Let's go play some football. Let's go!
Hey, everybody. Welcome into the Auction Brief. As the lady said, I'm your host, Drew Davenport. And thanks for joining me for episode 28. We're already 4 weeks in to this season of the Auction Brief, and I can't believe that the next time I'll be coming to you will be the last show of June, and we'll be into July, just a couple weeks away from training camp. That's unbelievable. I love it. I feel like I blinked and it went from April to July, but I'm churning out the content, and I'm so excited to be here for this show today because I got a couple fun auction topics that I absolutely love. Got a little bit of a legal update here, but I've got a great guest for you. Not that Drake wasn't great last week. Loved the conversation with Brian last week. One of my best friends, great analyst, and that was a good episode. In fact, you know what? If I'm being honest, that was one of my favorite episodes of all time. And it was just the combination of having a lot of fun with Brian, but also I love the intro last week. But this week is going to be awesome. I gotta say, I'm excited about this week. We have Dave Richard from CBS. Pumped about him coming on. Somebody I've met through the Kings Classic, and Dave is just such a nice guy, but also a killer in the draft room and really knows auction stuff. So we'll get a little bit more auction talk with Dave this week. As always, don't forget that this show is brought to you by FightingChanceFantasy.com. The wonderful folks over there, including our guest from last week, Brian, Steve Rappin, those guys, they're all doing great work over there. Give them a couple clicks, FightingChanceFantasy.com. They've supported the Auction Brief since the beginning. Don't forget, I'm on Underdog. Download the app. Throw a little bit of money on there. All you have to do is throw 10 bucks on there to get their matching bonus. But it's 100% matching bonus up to $100. You might as well just load the full 100 on there and roll out $63 drafts. It's going to be a fun summer, best ball mania, and tons of $3 and $5 drafts. So get on Underdog and use my promo code AUCTION. Don't forget, you can find me on TikTok as well at Fantasy Football Lawyer, and I haven't done one in a few, I think about 10 days now that I haven't done one because I've been waiting on some Deshaun Watson news, but finally some stuff happened today, and that's where we're going to start the show. Let's get into a legal update and talk about further developments in the Deshaun Watson case.
Now it's time for your legal update.
Okay, well, the news actually broke today that Deshaun Watson has settled some of the lawsuits against him. In fact, not just some, but a large percentage. He has settled 20 of the 24 lawsuits against him. That means he's got four hanging out there. Before I came on the air, I did check with Harris County to see whether or not the two rumored additional suits have been filed. They have not been filed yet. So as of the 22nd of June, we don't have 25 and 26 filed yet. But if they do, then he'll have six suits hanging out there. But he has settled 20 of the 24 suits. Excuse me. It's a fair question at this point to say, is this helping Watson in his situation with the NFL? Because that's, after all, you know, what we want to know. I don't think that him settling these suits matters a whole lot. And I know that I've been preaching that recently about the additional suits filed, and now he's settled some of these suits. And you might be thinking, well, why wouldn't it matter? Well, because I don't think that what the NFL was going to do was ever predicated on whether or not he settled these lawsuits or not. Now, I do think it helps from the standpoint that if he wants to settle with the NFL, part of what they might want is for him to wrap up these suits so it doesn't continue to dominate the news. Now, from that perspective, you could say it helps, But in general, I don't think that it matters with the paradigm the league is using about whether or not he violated the personal conduct policy, because that's independent of whether or not he settles the suits or not. So I don't think the settlement really moves the needle much for me. But I will say this. It could be a precursor to settlement of this case with the NFL Players Association. And what I said last week, and it's something that I think is really interesting, the NFLPA has said they're going to come in hot when it comes to the suspension because of these owners who are doing some of the same disgusting stuff and not getting suspended at all. And it's the NFL's words coming back to haunt them that they've said in the past, we have to hold front office people, general managers, coaches, to a higher standard than the players. So just today, we're finding out some truly disgusting stuff that's happening in Washington with Daniel Snyder. Some people are testifying to some stuff that's every bit as bad or worse than what Watson's doing over a longer period of time. Stuff that's happened back in 2009, 13 years ago, and nothing has happened to Daniel Snyder. So the NFLPA's threat to bring this stuff up with respect to the issue with Watson, that's a very real threat. That's not a bluff. That's a, hey, look, you better come correct. And I think that means that it's possible a settlement could be in the offing. And here's what I have seen as something that we should pay attention to that maybe everyone is not quite yet. These settlements happen, and it sounds to me as though they're going to be bound by a non-disclosure agreement. I believe there's going to be a gag order on all the parties not to talk about the settlement. And that represents a significant departure from Watson's stance throughout this entire case. So that's the main thing I want you to take away from this. Watson all along has been the one to say, I do not want an NDA. Why? Well, I've postulated that Watson wants to continue to talk about it and say, nah, I didn't do this, but I just settled it to get him out of my hair and so I could play football. I've said all along, I believe that that's what he wants. He wants to just go out there and say, no, I'm innocent, but I settled these. I don't know if that's true or not. That's a guess on my part. But what I'm saying is, all along, he's had this position about the NDA, and it appears that he's dropped that idea to settle these cases. And that's hugely important because that was apparently, according to his lawyer, Rusty Harden, who went on a podcast recently, that was the reason he didn't want to settle the case back in October when he had the chance to do so and get traded to the Dolphins, because he wasn't giving up this whole non-disclosure issue. But if that has changed and he's not willing to do that, that could be a precursor to the settlement of this case with the NFL as well. So that's interesting and something certainly that I'm going to keep my eye on. Right now, nothing has happened. I don't expect anything for a few more weeks, but I do expect something before training camp. So I'll keep an eye on that, and we will come back with another legal update next week. All right. I want to get into some auction talk next because I've got a couple really good topics that I love this week. Don't forget that next week is going to be just me running my FWM for the entire show. No guest. I know I had some open dates last summer, but we don't have as many shows this summer, so I've been trying to get guests for every show. But I am going to keep a couple dates open because I just like to talk auction for a long period of time and update you on some legal stuff, talk fantasy stuff that maybe I don't get to do with the guests. So one of those open dates will be next week. So I want to get into some auction talk next. I've got two really fun topics that I'm excited about, stuff that I hope is a little bit new and something for you to chew on as you go into your auctions this year, some new ideas that I have, not new, but different ways of explaining them to you that I think are really going to be beneficial. And on that note, I want to take a second to give a shout out to one of my favorite listeners. This is a childhood friend of mine, a guy by the name of Zach. It's really funny how life happens. I grew up across the street from Zach. I was friends with his older brother and older sister. He was always the young kid that, you know, tagged along, but was too young to really take part in some of the stuff that we did from time to time. But Zach always kind of hung around and, you know, he was the little brother. That's what it is. Like 2 years seems like 40 years when you're that young. But anyway, I've gotten to know Zach as he's gotten older. This thing happened through Facebook that Zach started listening to my show. And now he's an avid listener. And I look forward to the emails I get from him every week about the show and about things that he wants to hear or ways that I can improve the show. I don't think anybody out there has been a more influential listener as far as the content on my show. So, Zach, I hope you like these two topics, because your advice is always something that helps me to craft my next week's topics. And I think you're going to enjoy these, complete with lots of concrete examples about auctions. So let's get into it. Time for some auction talk.
Auction talk.
All right. And if I hadn't made it clear, the reason I gave Zach a shout out is because I love that input that he gives me. And I just want to say thank you to Zach in a public way for all the great feedback I've had on the show and for being such a huge fan of the show. Zach's going to be playing in Canton at the poker tournament, and I'm stoked about that. So again, thanks, Zach. Looking forward to seeing you in August. All right, what are the two topics I want to talk about? I put them simply like this. Topic number one, I want to talk about leaving valuable players on the board. And topic number two, I want to talk about my idea about quick bidding this year in a little bit more detail, because I referenced it in the offseason that I've got a new way of drafting this summer. It's not completely new. It's just changing a few things to give us a little bit more of an edge. And that's going to be topic number two, how I'm going to approach bidding in a practical way, not theories about bidding, but how am I actually going to do the bidding this summer? So those are the two topics I want to hit. Topic number one, I love this topic. And I think it's something that has to be said over and over and over, because I take for granted that when I start putting my stuff out on Twitter and on my podcast and in my writing and things like that, I take for granted that a large percentage of the public, eventually some of that, those ideas are going to percolate through the fantasy community, through the auction community, into people's brains. But of course, I don't think I have a widespread audience yet, because I don't. We're getting there. And the whole point is, I still see a ton of misconceptions and myths about what you're supposed to do in an auction room. And so I find myself repeating myself over and over about some of these ideas. And I feel like sometimes I'm shouting into the void that people aren't learning. And I just take for granted that, you know, people are hearing this stuff, but maybe they're not. And so let's keep talking about it as a community. All of you folks listening that love auction drafts, let's try to break down some of these myths out there. Frankly, there's a lot of them. And one of the biggest ones I hear is that early on in a draft, you should always call out big name players that you don't want in order to drain cap from other people. Now, I don't believe that's a bad idea in and of itself. Sometimes I am going to do that. Sometimes, but in very limited circumstances. And here's what I want to tell you about early nominations. The first thing you have to keep in mind is that if you reach too far down into the ADP sheet or your AAV sheet, then the players that you pick from down the sheet are going to have an inflated value, an extra inflated value early in the draft. So for example, let's pick wide receiver 40. And wide receiver 40, we call them out in the second round of the draft. People are still flush with cash, but you carefully selected wide receiver 40 because he's got a lot of hype on him from the preseason. It doesn't matter who it is. This guy's got some hype. People are talking about him. People are excited about him, but he's still wide receiver 40 in ADP. Call him out, and he's likely to go for a lot more money early in the draft than he would later in the draft. So the point is, there's no need for you to take your first nomination and call out Derrick Henry. You can if you don't want Derrick Henry. I understand that. But let's think of it another way. Because what's the point of calling out Derrick Henry? Do you think everyone else is going to forget about Derrick Henry? No. They're going to call him out for you eventually, and sooner rather than later. People don't, they can't stand leaving big players on the board. They can't stand it. Just watch. Just watch your auctions this year. People can't handle it. If six of the top seven receivers are gone, they're going to call out that seventh one, okay? It's just going to happen. People can't stand it. They're going to do that for you. What's the point of that? What's the point? What are you gaining from that? Now, I understand it's somebody that you don't want. Somebody else is, it's taken up their cap. Here's the thing that's interesting, is that a lot of times the market won't be set early in the draft it may not happen immediately. And I talk about this all the time. This is an inflection point. We're going to talk about that later in the summer, but it's an inflection point. Any of you Friends fans out there, it's called the sitting down bonus. Okay. Remember when they were playing the made up card game and Chandler was giving Joey money and he said, oh, you got the sitting down bonus and doubled his money. That's what happens at an auction. You sit down, people are a little bit tentative until the market's been set, and that may not happen immediately. So let them be tentative. Why go set the market? Let's say three players have come off the board and none of them are named Jonathan Taylor, Christian McCaffrey, or Austin Eckler. Why do that? Why call that out? Here's another way to look at it. You have a par sheet in front of you, right? So you know exactly what you want to pay for certain positions. But a lot of other people are not going to do that. In fact, most other people are not going to do that. They're not going to have an exact amount in front of them. Now, they have an idea in their head. Okay, I want to go for a top running back. But you have a par sheet. You know how much money you're saving. So you know what you can afford down the road as far as that RB1. You have that certainty in your brain. I got to save this amount of money. Even if you bought all your other players before your RB1, you know you've got $58 or $61 or whatever on your par sheet. You know you've got that money there. So you're relaxed about it. But people that don't have that, they have uncertainty in their head about what they're going to end up paying. And that uncertainty is hard for them to get their brain around because they don't know exactly what they're going to spend. And it gives them some anxiety and it's a bit vague for them. So they're like, yeah, I'm going to spend some money, but I just don't know what or who I'm going to get. And here's what happens. When you call out that player, let's say that there are four players in the room. And those four players are clearly going to be going for a top running back. Jonathan Taylor, Christian McCaffrey, and Austin Eckler have not been called out yet. You know these four teams are sitting on a top running back. So that means they're going to spend $60, $65, whatever. Let's call it just for math, just to make it easy on me. Let's say that they've put aside $60. It gets to you. And you've always heard the idea, call out people you don't want. Drain money from other people. So you do it. You call out Christian McCaffrey. You think, I don't want Christian McCaffrey. He's injury prone, not getting the injury discount, which, by the way, why aren't we getting a 2-year injury discount in Christian McCaffrey? Why aren't we getting an injury discount? It's wild. The guy's still the second or third running back off the board. He's been hurt for 2 years. He's not getting not enough dressing. Sir, I need more dressing. Anyway, back to the point. So you do the conventional thing. You call out Christian McCaffrey and he goes for $60. What has that done? Well, one of those four managers bought Christian McCaffrey for $60. What happened then? You took the uncertainty away from not only that first manager, but the other three as well. Because they know now they're not getting Christian McCaffrey. They know they haven't spent the $60. They're freed up to spend it somewhere else. I want to make this point a different way because I said this last summer, but I think it's an important enough point. We got to keep going with it. Fellow football guy staffer, Moral Trembley, made a great point this week. We have an internal conversation board that we talk about concepts and do our roundtables and stuff like that. And Moral made a great point. And he put it a different way that I've never put it before. And I thought it was brilliant. He said, if you believe that these people are in on that player, you have allowed that $60 to be subtracted from the room. Sure, you remove $60 by calling out Christian McCaffrey. But what money did you have tied up when Christian McCaffrey was not nominated yet? Well, there was four people who would possibly be in on McCaffrey. You've actually managed to tie up $4 times $60 while McCaffrey's still on the board. So you've actually tied up $240 in the room if you simply leave McCaffrey on the board. And now, like I said, somebody's going to call him out soon enough. And that should be all you need to know that why are you doing that? Let's get comfortable leaving big players on the board when it's your nomination. Just get comfortable with it. You need to find the buzziest players that you don't care about and nominate them early. Nominate RB26 that you don't care about. He went out and ripped off a 60-yard TD in the first preseason game. Call that guy out. You don't care about him. He's going to go way more than he should go if you call him out early. The other thing that we should be doing is we should be calling out players that that are going to direct our strategy one way or the other. I think there's two priorities. Number one, getting somebody to overpay on a lower tier player, and that leaves higher tier players on the board. That thereby ties up more money in other people's brains because they don't have a par sheet. Remember, you have the par sheet. Your brain is free to do what you want because you've got the cold, hard numbers in front of you to back up that freedom and flexibility. So that's step number one. Call out players lower down the tiers, try to drain money that way, leave the bigger players on the board. And idea number two is, why are you calling out players to waste money when you have a strategy you're trying to execute? I'm going to say this as much as possible. You should be calling out players early in the auction that push your strategy one way or another, that make your par sheet clarify as early as possible in the draft. The earlier you define your path, the better draft you're going to have. So I love this point. It's one of my favorite myths about auction drafting that I like to shatter. Get comfortable leaving big players on the board. Somebody else is going to nominate them. Don't worry about that. Call out the big players you want to drive your strategy and leave the rest of them on the board for other people to nominate. It all goes back to that thing that I always say about nominations. Control what you control in an auction. You don't have a lot of control over a lot of different things in an auction. One of those things is your nomination. So just being like, yeah, here, waste some money. Again, I don't think that's a terrible idea sometimes. There are times when you want to do that. But I think it's become far too commonplace that that's all you're supposed to do in an auction. No, our early nominations in the first third of the draft should have a very specific purpose. And I believe that the waste somebody's money on a top player is way down the list. Get comfortable leaving those players on the board. So your nominations should have a purpose, and that purpose should be the top two things that I've said, which are pushing your auction in the right direction and leaving big players on the board by nominating buzzy players from further down the ADP or the AAV sheet. All right, point number two. I like this point also because, like I've been saying since the offseason, I just have a new idea about how I want to put pressure on people this summer in auctions. Because I think one of the things that's underestimated in life, in sports, in poker, in fantasy football, in anything, is that when people win, they win by making the fewest mistakes. Coach Bob Knight was one of those who drummed this into my head when I was younger. The absence of mistakes will almost always mean that you're going to win. When do we make mistakes? We make mistakes when the other team isn't making them. You feel that pressure. You feel flustered. You feel like, how am I going to get the best of this person? And then you do something outside your character. I feel that all the time. When I'm in a bigger buy-in poker tournament, I always assume that the other players at the table have more experience in these high buy-in events. And sometimes I've been known to do things out of my comfort zone. That's what we're trying to do to other people, okay? We want to force them into making mistakes by keeping the pressure up on them. I think we can do that a lot of different ways. Targeted nominations are one of my favorites. But the thing that I want to focus on for this point is quick bidding. And it's something I talked about in the offseason. And I think I gave a brief overview. But I believe that one of the best ways you can keep pressure on your opponent is to bid quickly when you know that you want to bid. Somewhere along the way, in my 23 years or whatever of experience doing auction drafting, I've gotten it in my head that waiting until the very last possible second to put in a bid is a good strategy. I do think the strategy has its purpose at varying points in the draft, but not nearly as much as I previously thought. I think one of the reasons that you can wait is to flush out somebody else who's still interested, because a lot of times teams will go silent and let two people bid, but they're very much still, quote, alive in the bidding, that they're going to bid here in just a second when one of you stops. So I think it's fine to let the clock start to run down and make them think that you're done bidding and see if somebody else is going to jump in and make that bid. You got to be careful online. If you let it go down to 1 or 2 seconds for this strategy, you may not get that bid in. So I'd be very careful online. But live, I think you can wait right till the end and yell out your number right before the the auctioneer says sold, and you can find out if somebody else is still involved in the bidding. But I think that's one of the only ways that it's helpful, because otherwise I think it makes your opponent too comfortable. And I was talking with a buddy of mine the other day about this, and he called it a ramp up. And I really like that, because essentially what you're doing is giving the other person the ramp up time to figure out whether or not they want to continue bidding, to figure out whether this player works on their team or whether they can afford to spend the money. And look, ostensibly, you're going into this draft room as the most prepared person in the room. And if you're not, you're one of the most, if not the most, prepared. You're more than likely going to be more knowledgeable about auction concepts and more prepared about player values than anyone else in your room. So it begs the question, why would we want to give them time to think about their next bid if we don't have to? It goes back to something that I always say about poker. You know, I sit down at a table sometimes, and this doesn't happen all the time, but there are plenty of guys, and yes, it's guys. Women don't pull this nonsense. But there's plenty of guys who think that they're on the World Poker Tour on TV when they sit down at the table. No, bro, we're in a $100 buy-in. There's going to be 31 people in this thing at 10:15 on a Friday morning. You don't have to Hollywood every time it gets to you. There's no camera. You don't look cool. Everybody's just annoyed that you won't act when it's your turn. Not every decision is difficult in poker. In fact, the reason that kind of player frustrates me is that really about 99% of the decisions in poker are not difficult decisions. You should know most of the time when it gets to you exactly what you need to do. Of course, there are going to be times when you need to think. And that goes back to auction drafting. If you have your par sheet in front of you, and if you are prepared, then 99% of the time, you know what you're about to do. It's just like at a poker table. There's almost never a time when you need that time to think. And look, that's one of the exceptions. If you want to wait until the end of the timer because you need to think about this, then do it. Take your time. That's totally fine. I'm not saying not to do that. It's better to wait and make a good decision than to make a bid that you regret because you're trying to quick bid, okay? So don't confuse the fact that I just want you to go in there and be reckless, of course. I would never say to be reckless. This is from King Nit himself, the nittiest guy that you know. I don't want you to be reckless, but I believe that most of the time you know what you're doing. So you should be bidding quickly. And what does this do? Well, it puts the other person on the defensive. They don't have the time to ramp up their own thoughts. Frankly, it's intimidating to them. It's discouraging to them. They see this happening and they're like, ah, this guy's never going to stop. Because they say 25 and it goes like this, 25, 26, 27, 28. Going once, going twice, your opponent, 29, 30. You jump on their ass every time they make a bid. And that's discouraging. It's frustrating to them. It's probably irritating. I got to be honest. It's probably going to piss some people off. They're just going to be sitting over there irritated that that's what you do. And you can do this online too. You can be that relentless guy that every time somebody bids, you slam the bid in behind them. And you don't have to do it way up to their price point. Somebody will call out Austin Eckler and somebody bids 18 and then everybody sits there. It's like, what are we doing here? I know you're bidding 19. This is dumb. Click that 19. Get in the habit of just slamming that button as quickly as and fast as you can until it gets to a point where then you need to think about it. But you should be doing that and putting the pressure on. If you wait, if somebody starts Eckler at 20 and it goes by $1 from 20 all the way up to 50, you've given every person in the room the time to think about whether or not they want to pay that. Why give them that time? You're prepared. You know what you think about Austin Eckler. You know whether or not you're going to pay that for him. And if you have a tough decision to make, then take your time. Otherwise, you shouldn't be taking any time. Put the pressure on them. And I'll tell you what, it has another side effect. And I think I talked about this when I started talking about quick bidding. But there is no faster way to get people to stop messing with you in an auction than when you're quick bidding them and then you suddenly stop. Let's say, for instance, you know that you can't spend more than $32 on your RB2. But a couple of low-end RB1s are starting to stall out in the upper 20s, low 30s. And you think, you may have a chance at it. So you decide, I'm going to go up to 36 on one of these guys because I may be able to score him for just $4 over what I had set out for my RB2. So I think, okay, I'm going to spend 32, but I'll go up to 36. Okay, you don't have to get nervous when it gets over 32. You don't have to stop and be like, 33. And then the person bids and you say, going once, going twice, 35. You already knew you were going to do that. So there's no reason to get irritated, to give off a tell, to show them that you're getting close to your ceiling. And that's the other benefit of quick bidding. They don't know what your ceiling is. They don't know when you're getting close because your cadence never changes. And I remember watching a player by the name of Chris Ferguson on TV back in the day, and he would play. And what he did was he would sit the same way and put his hands over his mouth. And then every time it came to him, even if he wanted to check quickly or bet quickly or call quickly, he forced himself to count 1-1,000, 2-1,000, and then he would make his action. Because then people couldn't get a tell off of how quickly or slowly that he acted. That's what you're trying to do here. You're putting the pressure on them by not giving them time to think, number one, and number two, they're never going to know when you're about to stop bidding. And I'm telling you, the quickest way to get a reputation as somebody not to mess with is to just run that bid up real quick and then stop. So in the example I gave, you know you're going to bid up to 36. Then let's say somebody comes up who you think you would take as an RB2. Let's say Nick Chubb. Everybody knows in the room that you like Nick Chubb. So they're going to try to bid you up. And you think to yourself, okay, well, I don't really want to pay 36 for Chubb. So when it starts, you say, I'm going to keep it at 32. If I feel like it's going the way I want it to go and I can get it with a couple more dollars, I'll go up to 34. So you make your mind up as the bidding is early on with Chubb. And then you just start going at it. 17. 19, 21, and you're bidding quickly. Now the other person gets comfortable and they're bidding along with you comfortably. And they think that you're going to pay a bunch of money for Nick Chubb. So when it gets in the low 30s, 32, and they say 33, and you say 34, and then they go 35 because they think 36 is coming out of your mouth. And then you stop and they get the player for 35 bucks. Now, maybe they're happy with the deal, but the one thing that's going to stick out in their head is that they had no clue you were about to stop bidding. And that will make an impression on them. And if it doesn't, do it again. They will learn not to mess with you. That's the quickest way to get people not to mess with you. So I think there's a lot of benefits to quick bidding, and that's how we're going to do it on the auction brief. That's how I want all of you to start attacking your auctions. We talked last week about dropping the hammer. I'm going to talk even more about that in, I believe, next week's episode when I'm on the mic solo. I want to talk more about dropping the hammer. That's a way to keep the pressure on. This is also a great way to keep the pressure on. Quick bidding, it's got to become part of your repertoire. Be so prepared that 99% of the bids you can make are automatic. And like I said, you don't have to do this all the way up to the price point on every player. But when you're in the middle of bidding on a player, and this is particularly something that I think is important when you're heads up with somebody. And heads up means just one-on-one. I believe that allowing a person to think by letting the clock run down makes them way too comfortable in that heads up match with you. You want them to be nervous. You want them to be pressured. You want them to feel like, God, what is he doing? This guy's irritating. He's been doing this to me all night. He bids so quick. I can never even barely get my bid out of my mouth before he's jumping on me. If all that's in their head, they're not thinking about their team. They're not thinking about the season. They're just thinking about how to win, how to beat you. And you've taken them out of their game. Let's keep that pressure on. That's what we're going to be talking about all summer long. I'm stoked. We're already getting some of that out there now. All right, that's it for my second point on auctions this week. I think I'm going to leave it there. Have this be a little bit shorter episode this week. I know that's wild, but that's what we're going to do. I think these two points are awesome. I absolutely love them. If you have to, go back, listen to them again. You understand, as a disciple of this show, hopefully, disciples, is that a bad word? As a follower of the show, hopefully you've heard a lot of these concepts before. And I think that's great because you're hearing that all these concepts link together. They weave in and out of each other, and they're all things that you can apply together to give you that big edge on people. And again, both of these concepts aren't going to win every auction for you, but they're certainly going to make you a more effective auction drafter. All right. Well, let's wrap up the auction talk. Let's get on to our guest this week, because Dave Richard is truly one of the OGs of fantasy football. He's got a great story about how he got a start, and we really get in deep about some polarizing players at this time of year. We're still trying to figure things out. Training camp hasn't opened, but we do have some clues about some of these players, and Dave's a master at breaking it down. So let's get to this week's discussions with Drew and Dave Richard from CBS.
Time for Discussions with Drew. In-depth conversations with the brightest minds in the fantasy industry.
Okay, everybody, welcome into this week's Discussions with Drew. Very excited about our guest this week. We have Mr. Dave Richard from CBS Sports, and I like to say the Big Dog Room in the King's Classic. That's where I met Dave, and we've become acquainted through the King's Classic. But yeah, you're in the Jim Brown Room, which is the room I aspire to be in, but it's an awesome event. I can't wait to get back to Canton. Are you excited to get there in August?
Oh, counsel, it's good to hear your voice. And I can't wait to get back to Canton, yes. But I believe the room you draft in is a lot cooler of a room than the room I draft in.
That's true. I like our room.
Your room is like a lounge. Like, there's, you know, huge TV and bar stools and couches, and there's memorabilia in the room. It's a cool room. Our room is literally a conference room, painted beige. There is some memorabilia in that room too, but there's no fancy TV. It's kind of boring. It's kind of drab, actually.
I agree.
It's lots of tables and not as cool as yours. So I kind of want to trade, but for whatever reason, they won't do that. So I don't know. Yeah. I want you to be in the Jim Brown division too. As long as it doesn't cost me my spot.
Yeah. Well, now we've got this point system, I guess, we're instituting this year. So that should be interesting. Yep.
It's new. You can't totally suck. And I'll tell you a very quick story. Last year, I started our auction division 1-5. So immediately I'm thinking, I got to make a trade just so I don't finish in last, so I get relegated. I don't want to get relegated. I like being in the Jim Brown room too.
Right.
And so I made a couple of trade offers. One of them involved like me giving up Alvin Kamara and getting a package that included Tyson Williams. Like, it was the worst possible trade offer I think I could have made. But at the time, it seemed like it was sensible just to give me some depth, and it got rejected. And I kept the team going, and I went on a run, Drew. I went on a run, and I made the playoffs. And I made, was this the one that I made the finals in? One of them I made the finals in. I don't think it was this one, but I made the playoffs. I made the playoffs in both. It just goes to show you that you can have the crappiest of starts in fantasy, and you can still pull it out and wind up making the playoffs and going on a run. And that's how I avoided relegation in 2021. We'll see how I do it in 2022.
Well, 1-5 to the playoffs. That's pretty impressive. That is not easy to do, especially in that room.
No.
With all those sharks swimming in there.
I mean, listen, I'd like to think I know what I'm doing off the waiver wire, and I picked up a couple of good players. Devontae Freeman was one of the players that I ended up picking. I couldn't trade for Tyson Williams. What the hell? I'll get Devontae Freeman. And Devontae Freeman ended up being a good piece. And remember, and you know this because you're in the King's Classic, Drew, but for those who are listening, you start two running backs, three wide receivers, and I think there's three flex spots, mm-hmm. plus a tight end, plus a quarterback. And, I mean, you're basically anybody who's playing football. Like, if you have a pulse and you're running a route, you're going to be on a roster in these leagues. Mm-hmm. So it was just pick up anybody you can off the waiver wire. I did that, and just it worked out.
Yeah. People listening are thinking Devontae Freeman was your savior, but I'm telling you, in that league, I was upset because I had to drop him because I had injuries and buys. Couldn't drop anybody else. Had to drop him and thought, I'm not going to regret that. And then he just went on to score a bunch. And So if you ever want to have regret for dropping Devontae Freeman in 2021, playing a 14-teamer. Yeah, I explain this to people all the time. It's 140 position players being started mm-hmm. every week.
Yes.
And if you're in a regular, 12-teamer with kicker and D and one flex, you're starting like 70 something a week. So,
84.
or whatever. Yeah, I don't remember. But yeah, it's just a completely different paradigm, but I can't wait to get back. So, yeah. Well, anyway, nobody cares about our Kings Classic teams, right, Dave?
Well, they might care about who's popular in those drafts, Drew.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, here are a bunch of fantasy dweebs that do this for a living, and now they're putting their money where their mouth is. So I think there's some value for everybody out there that cares about fantasy.
Yeah. Okay. Point taken. So
yes, I got a point. Got a point on Drew Davenport. I love it because, you know, you're a lawyer. I'm going to lose every other argument we have, but this one I got.
Let's hope so. I bring you on the show just to make you lose, right?
I've got to be good for something.
No, this is a throw for me, man. It really is. So I want to talk a little bit about how you got your start at CBS and you're starting the business, because I get that question all the time. How can I latch on to one of these, how can I get on with football guys? How can I get on, you know, that kind of thing. It's a hard question to answer. How did you get your start in the business alone? And then how did you get to CBS?
It's a long story. I'll shorten it as best as I possibly can. This is the short answer. I fell ass backwards into it. If I had to expand on that, it's that I've been playing fantasy football since the late 90s. When I got my foot in the door at CBS, it wasn't to write about fantasy football, but people knew that I was a crazy fantasy football player. And I got serious about preparing for my leagues, and I started winning leagues regularly in 2001. In 2003, I was producing content for the NFL. The NFL was not sure, Drew, if the internet was going to be a thing. So they put the opportunity to produce their web pages up for auction. You know, fitting to mention that on this podcast. And CBS won the right, and they paid a lot of money to do it. And I was one of the first people they moved over. And by 2003, somebody from the NFL came to me and said, "You like fantasy? You want to write about it for us?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." It sounded good to me. So 2003, I started writing about fantasy on NFL.com. I was their first fantasy writer, did a live chat. There's probably about,
I had no idea, man. That's awesome.
About 200 people out there that might remember me from that time. And then a couple of years later, CBS said, "Why are we letting you do this for them when you can do it for us?" And they moved me over to CBSSports.com, and I've been doing, my title has been senior fantasy writer for the last 17 years. Wow. And same title, but the job has changed quite a bit because the internet has changed quite a bit. And it used to be just, you know, all text on the internet. And now there's, you know, video and podcast and TikTok. They're having me do TikToks, Drew.
Oh my God.
It's ridiculous. My kids are like,
"Follow you."
No, you don't. It's terrible. And my kids are like, "Dad, don't be cringy. Don't do TikTok." And it's just one of those things that we're doing. We're doing it as a group. It's collaborative. So it's not just me, you know, dancing at a pool or, you know, trying on clothes or something like that. But that's how I got my start. It was getting my foot in the door with a sports media company and then showing them that I was a hard worker and that I knew what I was doing and that I was willing to, you know, grow and develop even further, and just been this ever since.
That's so cool. I had no idea that you were in on the ground floor like that. That is a cool story, and that's why I like to ask these questions. So and before we get any further into the show, on Twitter you are, I think your handle is Dave Richard, sorry, excuse me.
Yeah,
but it's okay. Then it's Ask FFT is your name, right?
Yes.
Okay, because I want people to find you.
Right. So, yeah, just at Dave Richard. If you're looking for me on Twitter, that's where you go. If you want to read any of my content, you could literally go on Google and type in Dave Richard CBS, and there will be a link to all my content on there on CBSSports.com.
And most importantly, how do we find you on TikTok? You don't want to get
this
out
the
handle.
This is the first, Drew, this is, I don't know the handle. Oh, Drew, okay. This is, right. It's the first time I've ever talked about it because it's literally, I know TikTok isn't brand new, but it's brand new for us. Mm-hmm. My guess is that if I'm sure there's a search function on TikTok, and if you search for CBS Fantasy, something will come up.
I'm going to look you up. I'm on there as well now. I just had to transition away from the YouTube channel because I felt like producing my own videos was just eating up way too much time, and I wanted to get the information out there. And
got
TikTok's
it.
A perfect way just to get me get me out there. But anyway, well, that's cool, man. I love hearing your story. Let's get into some actual fantasy content here for folks listening, because
please,
I love having guests on to my show, because I tend to get into a mindset where I'm in a bit of a rut and going down the highway like, I've got this all figured out on June 20th, but we don't. And that's why I like having different perspectives. And there's certainly some polarizing players that I want to talk about. But before I get to that, one of my favorite questions I like to ask my guests, I feel like I've been in this almost 25 years now. You've been doing it at least as long. And I have to reteach myself some lessons every year, some mistakes that I consistently make. And I have to tell myself, stop doing that next year. Or I learn new things every year because we're never done learning. Does anything stick out from you, your experience in 2021 about what you had to learn?
Yeah. I don't know if it's a mistake. In some leagues it works out great, in some leagues it doesn't work out great, but you know, I can't help myself when it comes to running backs. I love to draft a lot of them, and I think that it's just the premium position and the numbers back it up, and it's just a position that I've always been attracted to for fantasy, because when you get the right running back and that dude's giving you over 20 fantasy points per week, you feel great. You feel great when you've got Jonathan Taylor on your team. He was on a bunch of my teams last year. There were people that were running away from him. Here's a lesson I learned from last year. You almost want to put on the horse blinders during training camp in the preseason and try not to have any of those headlines that are going to get a lot of attention, especially on social media, impact how you really feel about a player. And Taylor is a good example of that, because you'll remember, Drew, that during the preseason last year, not only did Carson Wentz have an ankle issue that might have cost him some time, he had to have surgery, I think, in July, but Quentin Nelson, the top offensive lineman for Indianapolis, also had to go on the shelf for a while. And people were starting to freak out about what that would mean for Jonathan Taylor. And it dawned on me maybe two and a half weeks before the season started that Wentz had a good chance to come back and Quentin Nelson was going to be back. And even if they were to miss one or two games, when they did come back, they should be, at least Nelson especially, in a position where they can do what they're paid to do, and that Jonathan Taylor could succeed with them back. And he could also have the chance to succeed before, because I really love the talent. So even before they were to come back. So I started moving Taylor up my rankings and prioritizing him in drafts before the rest of the world did. And some people never did. There were even guys on CBS like Jamie and Heath were not ready to take Taylor where I was taking Taylor. And so that's one of the lessons I learned. And I'm glad I remembered to say it now and speak it now, is that you kind of just have to have a little bit of foresight when you hear about injuries and whatnot in August. It's a time where we are bogged down in headlines. There's news coming every day, and sometimes it impacts us so much. Jamar Chase and his catches, another example, Drew. There were people that they didn't want to draft Jamar Chase. He's going to drop everything. He's not used to the NFL game. He hasn't played in a year. That's one of the reasons why I made it in the playoffs in the Kings Classic, is because I took him in both leagues. And anybody that had Jamar Chase knows how good he was, especially if you got into the finals with him in week 17. He was amazing then. So I think you just take the preseason with a grain of salt. That's one thing. The second thing is, this is more forward-looking. This is something that I learned after the season. I feel like NFL teams are going to be more committee-based across all positions moving forward. They're going to spread the ball out more when they throw it, and they're not going to try and force one lead back almost anymore. It's going to be rare occasions. You know the names of the players that are going to be lead feature backs, and even those guys are going to share to some degree. And so I think we're looking at a frustrating year in fantasy, where people are going to say, well, my guy's great and he's putting up, you know, 12 PPR points per game, but I remember when this guy got more targets or had more touches and he was getting me 15 or 16 PPR points per game. And maybe it means lower scores, and it's making me think twice about quarterbacks specifically, because that's a position, like the stud running backs, they put up a lot of points. And if teams are throwing, but they're diversifying where the ball goes, well, the quarterback's still going to get the points. It doesn't matter. You know, Josh Allen gets the same amount of fantasy points whether it's caught by Stephon Diggs or Gabriel Davis. Those points still go to Allen. And so it makes me think a little bit more about trying to find – I think I'm way more interested in drafting quarterback at a sweet spot, at a good value, than I am about saying, well, I'm going to wait until round 10 to get a quarterback. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about that and researching that, and that's something that will be in my tiers and strategies story. I do that every year, and that'll be in the magazine as well. Maybe this is the year where you just think that the depth is good enough at running back and wide receiver. And you know, you'll find a tight end that's a touchdown or bust guy later on if you want to. But quarterback, maybe the position that's worth the investment, because those players should be able to put up good fantasy points from game to game and won't have the inconsistency and the volatility, I should say, that a lot of other players around the league are going to have.
Well, that's your second point. I'm getting a healthy dose of confirmation bias over here, but I love it because I have been barking up this tree for a couple of years now that I believe that there is a little gap that's being created in specifically, I was talking about auctions, but I think it's also happening in snakes as well. There are some people who like the top quarterbacks, and especially in your casual leagues, you're going to have a lot of that.
Yeah.
Guys who really want the Josh Allen and those type of guys. But then there's quite a few people in your league who are going to be diehard, I'm going to wait people. And then that creates a little gap in there where there are some guys that you can get for very reasonable prices that are going to be better than your late round guys and be more consistent. So I love that. And as to your first point too, I talk about this every year. The training camp thing can really hurt you sometimes if you listen too much. And one of the things I think that's interesting that you pointed out about Taylor is that sometimes the ADPs don't rebound after incidents like this in the preseason. So where you think that Taylor should be, he gets a depressed number from those, you know, the Wentz Nelson question, and then it just never really comes back to where it should be. And those are guys that you really want to pay attention to, because training camp injuries are different than in-season injuries also. A lot of times, you know, I was scared off of Deebo Samuel last year because he came up injured in training camp, and I thought to myself, ah, here we go again. He's hurt again. And then he was just fine, and I was kicking myself for that. So those are excellent points. Excellent points. Okay, well, let's talk about some specific players, because we get into this time of year now where all we have to do is fight with each other on Twitter about these players. But these guys are polarizing for a reason, because there's a lot of arguments to be made on both sides, and that's why they pay you the big bucks. So I'm going to ask you about them. The first one is Patrick Mahomes. Doesn't get a lot bigger than that. So he's obviously missing his top guy coming into the year. They've tried to replace him with a couple free agent signings, but how much is Patrick Mahomes going to miss Tyreek Hill?
A hell of a lot, I think, because Tyreek Hill is the type of receiver who obviously can take the top off a defense. He's one of the fastest people in the National Football League, but he's also a willing target in short and intermediate areas. We've seen him on crossing routes and overs, catch the ball, make a guy miss, and all of a sudden he's chewing up space pretty quick. That's when the fantasy points really rack up. And he's been a constant target for him for a long time. And now it almost felt abrupt, Drew, how quickly he went from being a Chief to being a Dolphin. It felt like 2.5 hours. I know there's more into it than that, but it just happened out of nowhere. And it's just strange. And so what I think the Chiefs are going to do is try and diversify their passing game a lot more than what they've done in the past, because they've tried really hard to find a third receiver to go along with Tyreek and Kelsey. They've tried Sammy Watkins and Mahomes and Robinson. And now what I think they're going to do, they've collected all these new guys, and they're going to give Hardman one more try. And I think they're going to try and hope that two of them end up being equal to one Tyreek Hill. And they can mix and match who those guys are. They're going to be a bigger problem for defenses to match up with, because they're still going to have somebody on the field, whether it's Valdes-Scantling or Hardman or Sky Moore. Those three guys have speed. One of those guys is going to be on the field every single play. Defenses are going to have to adjust to that. Juju gives them a lot of that underneath opportunity. And I guess he's an okay catch and run guy. I know he didn't have a lot of explosive plays in Pittsburgh, but volume was certainly in his favor. And so if teams try and do cover two against them, he'll be a target. they're going to mix and match. And so while I don't think it means that there's going to be a serviceable replacement, you can't just do a one-to-one trade-off from Tyreek Hill to Juju Smith-Schuster or Tyreek Hill to Marquez Valdez-Scantling. It's not going to work like that. Those guys are going to be inconsistent. Kind of plays into what I said earlier about inconsistency from the non-elite players at each position. But I think Mahomes will be okay. That being said, he's not my top quarterback. He's not even my second quarterback. And he's kind of my third quarterback based on reputation and based on how I feel about Andy Reid and based on the number of targets that there are in Kansas City versus Patrick Mahomes, cannon arm quarterback, guy who's got, you know, his own cereal and, you know, just an absolute stud of a guy on and off the field. It's not quite like that. And I think he can get you 25 fantasy points per game. Is he going to have as many smash games as he had last year? How many 30-point games did he have last year? I'm asking myself as I look it up. Looks like 3-4. And this year, maybe he only has 3. And he had a bunch of games between 26 and 29 fantasy points. Maybe those fall to between 23 and 27. So I think he's going to lose a little bit, and I think he is going to miss having a guy like Tyreek Hill out there.
Yeah, because I look at his ADP, and I still see a lot of people wanting to take him at the 2 or 3 spot, QB 2 or 3. And I think, you know, I naively thought that maybe there'd be a little bit of value on Mahomes this year, but it doesn't appear to be the case. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops. And I do think that your point about the targets are just going to be very diffuse. You know, it's going to be maybe hard to predict on a week-to-week basis what pass catcher you want outside of Travis Kelce.
Right.
So
remember that on draft day when someone's telling you to take Juju Smith-Schuster in
rounds. Yeah, when you say 22 for Juju Smith-Schuster.
Oh, whoa.
Put something over your mouth and stop, because it might be very hard.
1-2 is okay. 2-2s, yeah, too right. much. 2-2, right. No 2-2 for Juju.
Hey, all right. That's a bumper sticker.
That's how you remember.
Let's stick with Tyreek Hill for a second here.
Yeah.
Because he goes over to the Dolphins offense. And
yeah,
again, one of the bigger topics of this offseason, can Tua support these two guys? Because Jalen Waddle's rookie year is pretty elite company, and there is a correlation between what he did his rookie year and future NFL success. But now you've got a real alpha there in Miami, and you've got Tua running the show. Is he going to be able to support both of these guys?
You know something, Drew? I've ranked it like he can. And I think it's easier to say that he can in PPR, but there's definitely a part of me that's nervous about him supporting both on even like a 60% basis. Mm-hmm. What I think I fear is that they can each get around 10 to 13 PPR points per game. And then one of them every couple of weeks is just going to go off and have a big game. And so there will be weeks where Tyreek has 28 PPR points and it'll be 10 for Waddle. And then the next week it'll be like 19 for Waddle and 11 for Tyreek. I think the Dolphins are going to – I think they know what limitations Tua has as a passer. And I think I'm sure they're encouraged that their offensive line is better. But that was the biggest issue for them last year, is that Tua had no time. That offensive line was just letting anybody through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hot dog vendors were coming on the field and lining up and breaking through the A gaps to get to Tua. I think you're going to see Tua get rid of the ball quickly. I know what the track record is for people who come from Kyle Shanahan's offense, that they like to run the ball and they want to use multiple backs. And I think that's true, but I don't, outside of Sony Michel, and Sony Michel is a solid running downs back, and Mostert when he's healthy, I think they're going to end up throwing a lot. I think that they're going to surprise people and end up passing quite a bit. And that's going to be how both Waddle and Tyreek become, at worst, quality number two receivers, with Tyreek having the upside. If he can stay healthy and, you know, break a bunch of plays more often than Waddle, they both could. He could end up being top 12. Waddle could be top 12 too. You can make the same case. They're both really talented, but I do worry about if I'm wrong and they run the ball a lot more, or if I'm wrong and Tua just continues to look like a mess, then of course it's going to be a disaster. What are the odds of that happening? I think they're pretty decent. They're probably right up there, the same type of odds of Tua being a breakout this year as him being a bust this year. I bet they're pretty close.
Yeah, I would agree. And one of the things I preach all the time is let's do a better job at assessing these situations for their complete bust potential and not just, hey, what can Tua do? What's the upside for these two guys? Mm-hmm. How can this all completely fall apart too? And that's part of the calculus we have to have.
Would you be interested in knowing how many times last year multiple Dolphins receivers had 15 PPR points in the same game?
Yeah.
Want to take a guess?
I would say it's pretty low. I'd say less than three.
So is your guess going to be zero, one, or two?
My guess is one.
Your guess is correct. There was one time last year, and it's a different offense, and Tyreek Hill is a different player. Sure. But one time last year where the Dolphins had multiple receivers. This isn't including Gesicki. Multiple receivers have 15+. It was week 11. Waddle and Mac Hollins. Everybody was starting Mac Hollins, right?
Everybody had him out
and
there.
And Tua was the quarterback. Tua had 20 fantasy points in the game. But Waddle had 20 PPR points, and Mac Hollins had 50. The only time last year, wow, multiple Dolphins wide receivers had 15+.
Yeah.
So, wow. Yeah, I'm starting to feel a little worse about those odds after digging that up on the fly.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, let's I want to hit a couple running backs because I could talk about the Dolphins offense all day, but we're going to do that all summer. And I think that you've hit the nail on the head there. There are possibilities of him breaking out, but also possibility of him just falling on his face too. So let's move on to, there's three guys that I keep coming back to that I can't make up my mind about. The first one's Rashad Penny. We know the pedigree and we know the story with Penny and the injuries and all that stuff. But every time he gets in there with a chance to show something, and gets some consistent carries, he looks incredible. And he puts up numbers that are, they're not just like, hey, he had 91 yards and a touchdown. He's capable of those big rushing games, those multiple TD games, those big plays. So is it kind of silly that he's going as late as he is still? Should we be taking more of a shot on him earlier? Or is the price right for what we know about him?
What's the price? What are you seeing?
Well, my ADP on him was, oh, shoot, I closed it.
Oh, shoot, that's late.
That's
my favorite. Would you say it's like round 9, round 10?
Yeah, so I've been – if you're going to get him, I think you have to reach around 8 or 9, yes. I've got him as RB36 on Football Guys right now.
Okay, let's go off of that.
Yeah, he's going – so it sounds about right here. What we were saying is, yeah, 9. Round 9. That's about right. Okay. So if he's so if we're looking at Penny in approximately round 9, how are you feeling about that price?
Oh, I'll never fault you for taking a chance on a running back with that type of upside in round 9. You just know what you're getting into with him because you said every time he's gotten a chance to play, he's looked great, and then something happens where he gets hurt and you're just worried about how long he'll be available to help your team. And then you've got the prickly issue of Seattle drafting Kenneth Walker, who, mm-hmm, I mean, my goodness, I think he's a perfect fit for that offense. I as capable as he might be of being a three down back, he was an excellent two downs back, both at Michigan State and at, where was he, Vanderbilt before then? I think that's where he was. And he's a hard-nosed one-cut runner who can do everything that Pete Carroll asked him to do and maybe a little bit more. And that's who I'm drafting first. I think the ADP will reflect that. Yep. Walker going ahead of Penny. I don't think I want to invest in both. And I don't think I want to invest in Penny if I'm going to spend, if I'm taking him in round 9, how many other, do I have 4 running backs already? And he would be my 5th running back. I don't know. Or even if I had 3 running backs already and he's my 4th, I'm not ready to make that type of investment in him, particularly because I'm pretty nervous about what the Seattle offense is going to look like without Russell Wilson and with Pete Carroll saying, fine, we're going to do it my way. It almost doesn't matter to them who the quarterback is. They're going to run the ball. And even when Penny's healthy, I don't know if they're going to feel comfortable giving him the majority of the work. Will he have the same, opportunity share as he had in the last 6 weeks of the season? My guess is no, not with Walker there. And for whatever it's worth, and this is just a guy sitting in an office in Fort Lauderdale, I don't think Chris Carson's coming back. I think if he makes some kind of miraculous recovery, hey, that's great, and he'll make things muddier for Penny. But he's someone that I'm not as excited about, other than zero RB target that you can find. I think round 9 is appropriate for him. And you hope he just gets you off to a good start of the season.
Okay. Yeah, it is. It's such a difficult situation to parse. And the argument you make against the Seattle offense is exactly the one I've been saying about Saquon Barkley. Not that I don't like the player, but they haven't scored any offensive touchdowns in the last 2 years. It's hard to be a top 12, top 15 running back when your offense can't move the ball. So Seattle certainly has that problem, that we anticipate that being a problem. But there's two other guys that also had some late season surges I wouldn't say surges for one of these guys, but Devin Singletary got the chance to carry the load and looked great doing it. And then we also had Cam Akers, who came back late in the year and then played in the playoffs. He was the opposite. He looked terrible. I know they played some really tough run defenses. He looked
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, he looked like
he could have played. He could have played against anybody. He would have looked that bad.
Yeah. So he made it back, but he certainly didn't have his burst. Do we buy either one of these guys? Now, Singletary, like I said, had a great end of the year, but now he's got competition with the rookie. And Akers, is it fair that we judge him off of what he did at the end of last year? How are we feeling about these two guys and their varying looks at the end of 2021?
I'll start with Akers. I am definitely judging him on how he looked at the end of the season and into the postseason, and he looked brutal, and the Rams didn't care. They still trotted him out there and let him get the carries and pick up 3 yards a carry. And it kind of made me go back and study how explosive he was before this. And remember, Drew, he'd been on and off the field as a rookie too. He had some great moments, but he also struggled to be efficient and explosive when he played before this injury. So here's where I come out on Akers. I'm not really drafting him. If he's waiting for me in round 7, cool. But someone's going to take him before round 7.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm going to let them take him until I see evidence that suggests that he's all the way back. And I know that we're not supposed to let day 3 rookies impact how we feel about incumbent starters, but I think Kyren Williams was a good pick for the Rams. And I think that's them signaling that they want to have a running back who can specifically work in passing downs. That would mean that there's a change in how the Rams are using their running backs. Before, when they had Gurley, of course, with Gurley, when he was in his prime, they'd run him out there all the time. And Akers had a bunch of games, including last year in the playoffs, where he dominated. But I wonder if they're going to try and shift from that and use multiple running backs each week. And again, water down the position, especially our glorious fantasy position of running back. Singletary is going to experience the same thing. James Cook is there for that exact reason. But the book on Cook was that he was a great passing downs running back and a great route runner. And I think the Bills' actions this offseason, when they tried to get J.D. McKissick and he jilted them for Washington. I don't know why he would do that, but he did. I think they wanted to add that element to their offense. They wanted somebody who could catch passes out of the backfield, and they settled on Cook in the draft. But Singletary can catch passes too. And if James Cook isn't quite ready, I just want to remind you, in his final 5 games of the regular season, Devin Singletary averaged almost 19 PPR points per game. In those 5 regular season games and the 2 playoff games, he averaged about 18 touches and 88.1 total yards per game. He scored 9 times. He had his opportunity to break out last year. He showed the Bills coaching staff that he can do it. This Bills team, all they did was add Cook. And unless Cook becomes the next Alvin Kamara in short order, Singletary is going to get work. And it's not like he's going to get a ton. It's Buffalo. I get it. It's the reason why Josh Allen is number one. But Singletary also did something, and I kind of glossed over it with the touchdowns, but he was good in short yardage situations, whereas previous running backs that they had, be it Zach Moss or Frank Gore, they'd struggle. And it was Josh Allen cleaning it up, and he'd be the one rushing for touchdowns. I think Singletary can pick that up. I think he's a good yards creator. I felt that way since he was at FAU. And I think he can actually exceed what he did last year. He had almost 1,100 total yards and 8 total touchdowns. I think he's got a shot at beating that. He's someone that I'm looking at in that round 6-7 range as a number 3 running back that could finish as a number 2.
Yeah, and he's going as RB32 right now in redraft. Boy, that just feels real low for what he did at the end of the year. And even if you don't believe that he's going to get all the passing down work because of the rookie, you still have to. I think taking a shot on him there at RB32 seems like a no-brainer. Going behind guys like Tony Pollard and Clyde Edwards-Helaire and Cordarrelle Patterson. It feels a little bit odd. Maybe that's going to correct itself coming to August here.
The only way it corrects itself is either A, the Bills add another running back, or B, James Cook looks like Alvin Kamara, like I said. Because I don't think Buffalo will resist that. And I also think Buffalo, if Singletary gets off to a slow start, I don't think Buffalo will resist using Cook more and Singletary less. So you mitigate some of that risk when you're taking him as the RB32 off the board.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels baked into the price. So
yes,
I'm on Singletary where he's being drafted right now for sure. Akers, I kind of feel a little bit like you do. Like, I don't mind taking him, except that somebody's always going to be more interested in him than me. Mm-hmm. One final guy before I want to get into some auction talk with you, because you know, you do the auction over at Kings Classic. I'd be interested to hear some thoughts about how you approach auction drafts before I let you go. But one guy that I keep going round and round about is Mike Williams. We're all familiar with the fact that he struggled a little bit at times last year from weeks 1 to 5.
Oh yeah.
Unbelievably, he had 2 games over 30 points, 2 games over 20. And then from week 6 on, he was the PPR wide receiver 39, and he went over 20 points only one time and had 6 games in single digits. I know he's attached to Justin Herbert. I know Keenan Allen's a year older, but which Mike Williams are we getting next year?
I think outside of those 5 games, I think you know what you're getting with him.
Right.
And I'm looking to find the stats. You did a great job of talking about how great he was in those 5 games. And then after that, he had some good moments and he still got great opportunities, Drew. There was a game he dropped 3 end zone targets in a row. The remainder of the 21 season, I found the numbers. Okay, here we go. You mentioned it. The first 5 games of the year, 23 PPR points per game, best stretch of his life. It was the only time in his career he had back-to-back games of 15-plus PPR points. The remainder of 2021, 12.4 PPR points per game, which would have ranked wide receiver 32, which is a notch better than Darnell Mooney was last year. It's another guy I'm not sure of. I wish we could talk about him. But 12.4, that was the number from week 6 on for Mike Williams. All of 2020, his PPR average, 9.7. All of 2019, his PPR average, 10.3. All of 2018, his PPR average, 10.8. 12.4 PPR points for Mike Williams is actually good for Mike Williams. Like, that's higher than he had been at any point prior in his career. And he just got paid on top of it. When you draft Mike Williams, assume that that's going to be right around where he averages in 2022. He might do better. He might be around 13 or 14 PPR points per game, but I don't think he's got, I don't see him breaking through to another level this year. I think he's still going to be kind of a clumsy wide receiver that fantasy managers are going to be annoyed by.
Yeah. And the stark contrast, when you look at his target numbers, I don't know what happened, if they decided he couldn't handle it or something changed.
It's a couple of things. I think that might have been a little bit of it, but I think a knee injury may have really impacted him too.
Okay.
But I'm still not ready to say, I'm not going to give him a pass for that, because the numbers from week 6 on are too close to his career numbers coming into last year.
Yeah, and I talked about that quite a bit last year with David Montgomery about how he had that nice stretch at the end of the previous year.
Yes.
And then what are we placing our stock in? The majority of his career is this profile that we've seen, that he's a 10 to 12 point guy. Mm-hmm. And then he had the stretch here and people are going bonkers. He kind of went back to what he was this past year. So maybe Mike Williams is who he is at this point, and we ought to ignore the 33-point back-to-back explosion there in early in the season. Okay, well, good stuff. I want to talk a little bit about auction stuff before I let you go, because
sure.
I think that people on the show want to hear that, but also I respect the fact that you compete against some tough people in that Kings Classic auction room. But I don't actually know how much auction do you do outside of the Kings Classic every year.
I think I'm in one other auction league every year minimum.
Okay.
On top of the Kings Classic. The auction league of the Kings Classic is my favorite league that I play. No offense to my friends who, my home league that I've been in since 97, and no offense to the leagues that I'm in here at the office, but that's my favorite one. That's like, if I could win a league in the Kings Classic, it's the auction. It's so tough because everybody knows what they're doing. Everybody has all the information. You just have to kind of look for values and bargains along the way. And it's funny. We all have our ways of keeping track of how much budget everybody has left in their salary cap. And I sit next to Mike Clay almost every year. And Clay's got this, first of all, he's got this huge laptop. And second of all, he's got these programs on his laptop that tell you what percentage of total budget among all the fantasy managers have been used, and that when to target and get players. And he's really good. So if you're asking me what I do to prepare for these, I tier players at every position. I put them into groups, and then I kind of let the bidding unfold a little bit to get an idea of what everybody's price is in the early going. So just random example, let's say that in my top tier of quarterbacks, I've got Josh Allen, Justin Herbert, and Patrick Mahomes. Okay, not a stretch. That's what I got. And Josh Allen goes off the board for 20, and Patrick Mahomes goes off for 21. Well, now I know I have a pretty good idea on what I should spend for Justin Herbert. I like to go after the last player or the last two players in my tiers, because I already know what the going rate is. And sometimes I can get them for cheaper than that going rate. And so that's one strategy I use. I do like to keep track of how much money everybody has. I will try and nominate players at the beginning of the draft. I will nominate players I don't want, because I want people to spend their money. But I'll see that there's a manager in the league that's got 80% of his budget left. I want him to start spending. I'll pick a position that I think is either deep or one that I've already got filled, and I'll start nominating players to get that other manager to start spending his money. I also follow this rule. I call it the 20-50 rule. I want to save 20% of my overall auction budget for the last 50% of the nominations, meaning that I'm going to earmark, if I'm in a $200 league, I'm going to earmark 40 of my auction dollars to spend on the last half. And I don't care if I spend, the other 160 on three players or if I spend it on seven players. I want to make sure I've got money left over to pick up the bargains in the second half of every single auction that I've been in, Drew. And I know you'll agree, there are bargains galore. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm looking for, by trying to force myself to save some of my shekels to spend at the end of the auction, so that other people... so that I can get the steals, not so that other people can get the steals.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. The 20-50 rule. I've actually never heard that before. And you better put a trademark on that. I'm going to steal that from you. I love it. I love it. So, well, yeah, it's a tough thing to do when you walk into the Kings Classic because of the 14 teams and the number of starting spots. It is so difficult to find the value considering who you're drafting against and how deep it goes. And every time I thought I had a guy locked up, there was Scott Pianowski in the corner, and he would yell out some numbers to make sure I didn't get a deal.
Is he your rival?
Gosh, yes. Him and Steve Rappin, they know I'm about to get a deal and they bid every time. It's it's a tough room, but let me pull it back a little bit, because there's a lot of people listening who want to get into it and they get a little little nervous about, like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I always try to tell people, if you know fantasy football, it's hard to screw up an auction too bad. Like, don't not do it just because you're nervous about it. But what would you tell some people that are either new to it or haven't done it at all? What are some things that you remember helping you at the beginning in an auction?
The tiers thing is crucial. You're going to need to spend some time. You can't just walk into an auction and think you're going to kill it.
Agreed.
You'll be the one getting killed if you do that. So get a hold of somebody's rankings or make your own rankings, and then just create dividing lines where you think you're basically, when you make tiers, you're grouping players together based on expectations. Okay. And the top guys at quarterback, well, those are the guys they think have a chance to, you know, have the equivalent of 26, 27 points per game. And then the next tier, those are going to be the guys that are going to be around 23 to 25. And then the next tier is probably going to be, I'll narrow it down a little bit and get a little granular, 21 to 22. And then, you know, so on down the line, and you do that for each position. And then when you group these guys together and you start to see one, two, three players go from these tiers that you've made, you know exactly what you should be spending on the other players in those tiers. Right. I think that's huge. The other thing that I'll tell you is that it tends to be that there's two things I want to do. One is the Jamie Eisenberg rule. Jamie, I said I nominate players that I don't want first. I shouldn't do that. Jamie will nominate a defense with his very first nomination every single time. And it's the defense that he wants, and he nominates it for one. And that means that if you want the same defense, if you want the Rams defense, you either have to nominate them before he does, or you've got to spend two to get it. All right. And I don't know if there's ever going to be a defense or a kicker ever again that's worth more than one. So I'm not opposed to spending your first nomination on a defense or a kicker. I wouldn't do it with a bench player that you just absolutely love, because everybody will have their budgets and they might be more willing to spend two or three on that player. So that's one thing. And then the second thing that I'll do is I'll have a confident idea on how much I'm willing to spend on the elite tier guys. And it's usually right around a little more than 30% of whatever the total budget is. And I'm talking the top of the running back list. Top of the wide receiver list will be lower than that. That'll be probably closer to 25% of your total budget. And if the auction's just starting, and the bidding is going on, and it's Derrick Henry, and he's only going for 20% of a total budget, I'm getting in there. And I don't mind spending a little bit early on if I think it's his value, if I think it's a steal. I've felt good about doing this in the past, where I get a star player at a price that I think is maybe even just $2 or $3 lower than what I would expect to pay. And then I watch four or five other players that are nowhere near, well, kind of near the realm of the player that I got, but they're going for a little bit more. It's a great feeling to know that you can draft Derrick Henry to your team for 24 and you see Joe Mixon go for 26, or you see who do I have behind him? Nick Chubb go for the same price, something right. like that. And you feel like, okay, awesome, I got a steal. So make tiers before you go in. And have a good idea of what you're willing to spend for Jonathan Taylor. And then you just kind of work your way down. And then when those early nominations come, because those big names get nominated early, you'll be able to pick them up at a price that you'll feel good about, or you'll pass on them because they're going for as much or more than you thought they would.
And I think that you made a couple important points there too, that I want to jump off of. That number one, that when you're early in a draft, the general rule is you shouldn't be calling out the players that you're sitting on for later in the draft, because it may feel like you're going to get a deal because nobody cares about that player right then, but they have too much money. So if you're too early and you're reaching too far down into the rankings, the price is going to be inflated rather than getting a deal. So that's a good point. And then the other thing that you talked about that I really liked was the level of preparation walking into an auction is just a different level. And you have to tell yourself that you can't print off a cheat sheet and read a few things for for an hour before you walk into an auction. It's just not the same. You're still going to have fun and you're still going to enjoy yourself, but you're not going to excel like you want to. So the level of preparation is just different. I try to impress that upon people that's yes. important.
Or you just go into it without it and you're dead money in your auction, you know.
And me and Dave will happily accept your entry fee.
Find us on Twitter. We'll let's start a league.
All right. So I want to get your take on individual, like how you handle individual positions. Before I do that, though, there are some mistakes I see people making every year. And this is, I'm not really talking about my expert leagues. I'm talking about my casual home leagues. Some guys will come into the draft and just do the same thing every year. And it always amazes me that they don't learn from their mistakes. So what are some common things that you see people do that you wish they didn't do?
Take quarterbacks early. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you'll see it as bad this year. I don't think you're going to see a quarterback go in round one this year, but I bet you see Allen go in round two. And as good as he'll be, I just don't think he's worth taking that early. I want a difference maker of that position, but I want to get him at a good value. I see people draft six receivers when they don't have to start more than three. If three of those receivers are late round guys, that's one thing. But some people like to go ham with receivers, and this would apply to running backs too. You don't want to overdraft a position to the point where you've got guys that you can't start. At least with running back, that's the best currency in fantasy is running backs. If you've got a bunch of running backs and they're all doing well, you should be able to trade one and get a lot for them when the season's rolling, and you can improve at a different position. So you got to kind of stay balanced. And one good way to do that is to not take three of the same position in a row. Try and mix it up a little bit more in your draft. The other thing I'll tell everybody is that they should be more open to trading. And not that you do that during a draft. Don't be afraid to trade. There's never been more content designed to help people make trades than there is now. 10 years ago, I started doing the trade chart on CBSSports.com, which gave people a real simple way of figuring if a trade was fair or not. And now there's all kinds of stuff out there that people can use to help make trades. And I'm so tired of being in this league or in leagues where I'll say to people, hey, you know, I got a player. I think he'd help your team. You've got a player I'd like. You want to work something out. And they don't even engage. Everybody's so scared to get ripped off. And there's just there's so much information on the internet now, and even social media. And you can even reach out to your favorite fantasy analyst and hope to get their opinion on social media. There's so much out there to help you make a fair trade or an unfair trade if you can pull it off in your favor, if you know what I'm saying. Be open to trading more. Don't just shut it down because you're scared of getting ripped off.
Okay. All right. Wise words here from Dave. All right. I want to talk about specifically your takes on the position groups, and then I got to get out of here. And I've kept you long enough. But when
I'm having fun.
So am I. This is like I could do this for 2 hours, but we got lives to get to. When I go into an auction, I know that in most of them, the format's not going to affect. Now, obviously, if it's a super flex, it's different. But let's put that aside. In most one quarterback leagues, I'm going to go in with almost the same strategy in every league about how I want to attack quarterback and tight end because they're pretty predictable. How do you feel about the onesie positions when you're in an auction?
The onesie positions?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
We already know it's $1 for kicker and D, but how about quarterback and tight end?
I've been in the position where I've spent $1 on a quarterback and a tight end too. Sometimes you can't help but take advantage of some good value at running back and receiver. I'm whether it's a draft or an auction, I'm looking to get good value at quarterback for sure. There's enough quarterbacks out there to where you can wait a little bit, but not you shouldn't force yourself to wait until round 9 or round 10. I was in a draft last week where Russell Wilson was headed my way in late round 8 and I needed a quarterback. I noticed I was picking in the 2 slot, so I had the second last pick in round 8 and the second pick off the top in round 9. And the team that was in the first slot already had a quarterback. So I knew that I would have taken Russell Wilson in round 8, but I knew that the guy wouldn't take him with his back-to-back picks. So I took a different position. sure enough, Russell Wilson was waiting for me in round 9. It was a player who I think has good upside, if not great upside, that I'm getting at an incredible value, almost too good to be true value. Mm-hmm. And I think we talked about that gap. That's the sweet spot that everybody should look for a quarterback. That's what I'm looking for, a quarterback. So, and I'll double down. What's up?
I was going to say, so you're not going for $20 for Josh Allen or something like that. That's just
not. I'm not going to be the guy in the Kings Classic that spends 20 on Josh Allen.
Yeah.
I've got a price for Josh Allen in my mind. It's not too far off from 20 in the Kings Classic, but it's not 20. I'm going to let somebody else spend 20 on Josh Allen. And good luck to you with that, especially since I'm pretty sure I could get Justin Herbert for less than that.
Right.
And he's my number two quarterback. So why would I spend 20 on Allen when I can go? And as here's a fun fact. As good as Josh Allen was last year, Brady and Herbert were both, they had round 6 ADPs, and they were definitely cheaper in auctions. They were less than one full point per game worse than Allen. And they didn't run like Josh Allen did. So I'm totally fine with waiting on that position. Tight end's a different story. I'd like to get a good tight end. It's easier. I think it's easier to get a good tight end in auctions than it is in a draft. I think people are a little hesitant for whatever reason to spend on a tight end. But when it comes to drafting them, they don't mind reaching. It's just a weird thing. Maybe it's only in my head. But no, I
a fair point.
Yeah, I'm looking for a fair value at tight end, I would say, because that's a position that I'd like to have a shot at being advantageous over the majority of my league. And I've picked Pitts in a lot of leagues. He's managed to be there in round 4 in some drafts I've been in. And I know this Falcons offense isn't going to be great, but I can't pass up a guy who was in a bad offense last year and still finished with over 1,000 yards. And I'm pretty sure he's going to have more than one touchdown.
Yeah,
for sure. So I can bank on him, and I think Waller can be okay. Kittle makes me nervous. Dalton Schultz is one of my favorite guys to draft too.
Okay,
so that's a position that I might prioritize a little bit and be more willing to take a fair value, you know, or hit ADP right on the mark with those guys versus trying to get a bargain like I would a quarterback.
All right, fair enough.
Can I give you one last point on those positions?
Absolutely.
It'll probably be tight end more than quarterback, but I intend to spend at least one bench spot trying to get a blue chip player on those 1Z positions.
Okay.
Just in case I hit on that player, or if I miss on the guy I spend on earlier, but I hit on the late round guy, which happens in fantasy. I want to have two irons in the fire at one of those positions. It'll probably be tight end. And there's a lot of tight end sleepers I like this year, from Gerald Everett to Austin Hooper. I mean, everybody's on Albert Okwuegbunam, but I don't think I'm going to be. There are some tight ends that look kind of fun. And I don't mind spending $1 or $2 in an auction or a double-digit round pick on, even if I go and get Kelsey or Andrews or, you know, Pitts, Waller, Schultz earlier in the draft.
Yeah, I'm always a fan of that because, and my listeners are sick of hearing me say it, but I'm a risk-averse guy. So in general, I like to spread out my risk a little bit, and that means that I'm usually going to draft several tight ends in an auction that I'm in.
I get it. Totally get it. Does that mean you take receivers early?
So I have been, but I feel the worm turning on this a little bit, that people are much more focused on drafting volumes of receivers because it's so deep. So I've noticed that, and I've been shifting away from that a little bit because I've noticed that happening, to try to get these mid-tier running backs who are just, the price seems to be falling off a cliff on some of these guys. So I've been paying attention to that, and I really think that, especially I noticed it in the Kings Classic the last 2 years, people realize that these flex spots, they want to fill them out with receivers, and so the competition for the receivers that we really shouldn't be competing for that hard has been higher than I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, well, I've already heard, before I let you go, let's briefly hit running back and wide receiver. I've already heard that you're a robust running back guy, it sounds like to me. How do you square the values at those two positions? Because those are where the majority of your budget is going to go. how much do you like to sink into both of those positional groups?
A lot. You'll see me spend quite a bit on running backs and wide receivers, and probably a little bit more on running back than receivers, just because, call me old school or whatever. I just think that's the lifeblood position for fantasy. If you want to, let's put it this way. If you needed to fill a position off the waiver wire in a given week, what's the easiest position to fill? I would answer that with quarterback or defense. If you're in defense, I think tight end is, you can do it. And I think with wide receiver, I think you can find a wide receiver that can give you a 12-point PPR floor pretty easily. But with running back, especially if you're low on fab or not at the top of your waiver wire, you're going to have a devil of a time trying to fill that spot off the waiver wire. So I want to fill that spot on draft day with starters and good depth and just hope for the best with those positions. It's worked for me. I know that zero RB has worked for people too. I'm not saying that that's a bad strategy. If you've used zero RB in the past and you're really good at finding running backs off the waiver wire, or maybe you purposely get off to a slow start in your fantasy league so you can hoard running backs in weeks 1 through 4, so you can get all the Elijah Mitchells of the world on your team, you know, that's a strategy. It can work, but I like having the big name running backs who it's not a high percentage of the time that they come through, but when they do come through, they're great. Whereas receivers that come through, I mean, for every Cooper Kupp, there's, you know, a dozen Elijah Moores.
So now does that, when you're talking about running back, does that extend to the top of the position? Are you going after the RB1 and RB2 in auctions? Okay.
Yes. But if it's early in an auction, I'm going to try, like, I think Jonathan Taylor in a $200 budget, I think I have him right now at like 70 to 72. Okay. If the bidding gets to 76 or 77, even if it gets to 74, Drew, I'm out. I know I can find somebody else later.
Yeah, I agree. And it's never been my style to go that way. But I always tell people what's beautiful about auction drafting is you develop your own style, and any style can work if you have the grounding of the basic concepts of how to succeed. So. Well, this was awesome, man. I got to meet the kids and wife for dinner and a tournament soccer game for my 7-year-old.
Oh,
so I got to get out the door. Yeah, it's cool. It's cool. So this has been awesome. I could do this for another couple hours. We have so much we could talk about, but I'm looking forward to Canton and maybe getting together, maybe having a cup of coffee or having a beer. Are you going to be there a little bit longer this time or no?
I don't think I am. Unfortunately, I think I'm going to, well, you know, that's just how it goes. I turn these into business trips.
I understand.
And it looks like I'm going to have some business the night of the Kings Classic. So drafting during the day and football at night.
Okay. Well, I understand. Maybe when we eat a hot dog on the break, we can catch up.
But, perfect.
Thank you again for coming on.
Yeah. We'll grab a dog and we'll go look at some of the busts in the Gallery of Heroes.
Sounds cool, man. I'm looking forward to it. And this has been awesome for me. It's been a thrill to have you on, and this was a great conversation. So thank you again to Dave Richard. Don't forget, you can find him on Twitter at Dave Richard. That's DaveRichard. And of course, over at CBS Fantasy Sports. When you talk about OGs, this is one of the true OGs in the business. So it's been a pleasure sitting down. Thanks again to Dave. And that'll do it for this week's Discussions with Drew. All right, Dave, nice job. Man, that was a fun conversation. I say it every time, but I could do that all day long. It's just so much fun talking football, trying to get into some of these difficult situations and make some sense out of it for all of you. Hopefully you're learning a lot about fantasy football, not just auction drafting, but player evaluations and how you should be attacking your drafts. We're going to keep it rolling. Next week I'll be solo, but the following week I have a fun guest coming up. Jordan McNamara is booked on the show. We might get into a little bit of dynasty talk. I won't bore all of you non-dynasty folk, but Jordan is one of the top names in Dynasty in the business.
He'll be joining us, followed by Marcus Grant, Liz Loza, Rich Rebar's coming, Matt Schaaf. This summer's loaded up. I am pumped. Thank you for joining me for episode 28 of the Auction Brief. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Drew Davenport FF, on TikTok, Fantasy Football Lawyer. Download Underdog, do some best ball drafts, spend a few bucks to try to become a millionaire, or come do a $3 draft with me, promo code AUCTION. It's so easy to download Underdog on your phone. Load up some money, use my promo code, and get a matching bonus. I hope to see you in the draft room. Thanks again to CBS Sports' Dave Richard. He did a fantastic job. This has been an awesome episode of the Auction Brief. Thank you so much for joining me. The Auction Brief is adjourned, and I am out.
The Auction Brief is adjourned. That'll do it for this week's episode. See you next time on The Auction Brief.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.